From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the memoirs of a writer who has finally stopped trying to kill himself. We talk with Jim Kniffel. His new book is about his suicide attempts and the 6 months he spent in a psychiatric hospital at the age of 22. His earlier memoir was about the congenital illness which has left him legally blind at the age of 35. Sounds like fun, huh? But his new books have been praised for their wit and for being kind of uplifting in their own strange, grumpy way. Also, Ken Tucker reviews Billy Bragg and Wilco's second volume of Woody Guthrie lyrics that they set to music. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Los Alamos National Laboratory has confirmed that classified information that was stored on computer hard drives is missing. The laboratory's director, John Brown, declined to give details, but he said the FBI and investigators from the Department of Energy are looking for the material. The New York Times reported on its website today that the missing information included U.S. and Russian nuclear secrets kept on hard drives that were stored in locked containers in a vault. The report said the hard drives turned up missing when investigators searched for them after the facility was threatened by a wildfire last month. A delegation of Arab-Israeli parliament members will attend tomorrow's funeral of Syrian President Hafez Assad. Israeli defense officials say they expect a smooth transition of power in Syria. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
The Israeli Arab Knesset members will cross from the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights to Syria through a border crossing run by the United Nations. Hundreds of Druze residents of the Golan waited from the early morning to cross the border to attend the funeral. Israel Radio reported that about 100 had permission, but Syria had only 59 names on its list. The Druze scuffled with Israeli police, and all of them returned to the Golan after they were not allowed to cross. Meanwhile, senior Israeli military officials said they expected Hafez Assad's designated successor, his son Bashar, to maintain his father's policies. They said Israel has not moved any troops after Assad's death, and they believe there is no threat of violence from Syria. Israeli-Syrian peace talks were frozen for 4 years, but revived briefly last year. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Officials from the Environmental Protection Agency and the Energy Department met in Washington with leaders from the oil industry today to discuss skyrocketing gas prices in the Midwest. NPR's Guy Raz reports.
The EPA summons the oil executives to Washington after gas prices topped $2 a gallon in Chicago. The EPA believes that gas supplies are adequate in the Midwest. Officials at the agency suspect price gouging. The oil industry blames higher prices on new EPA regulations that require cleaner burning but more expensive gasoline. White House spokesman Joe Lockhart indicated that if price gouging is suspected, the president may order the Federal Trade Commission to investigate.
I know that there are people that are looking at this now. I think ultimately, if there is evidence of price gouging, this would have to be referred to the FTC.
Analysts suspect that reduced supplies in the Midwest, coupled with the traditional summer increase in demand, have contributed to the higher costs. Guy Raz, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 50 points to close at 10,564 in light trading. The Nasdaq Composite lost 107 points, or 2.7%, to close at 3768. This is NPR News. The Justice Department will pay $18 million to the estate of former President Richard Nixon in exchange for thousands of tapes and documents that were seized by the government. The payment would settle a long-running lawsuit filed by the Nixon family, which initially asked for $35 million plus interest that would have accrued over 25 years for a total of more than $200 million. The American Medical Association, meeting in Chicago this week, is considering a resolution to support a national moratorium on the death penalty. Jason DeRose reports from Chicago Public Radio.
Public health physicians argue the death penalty should not be enforced until questions regarding the availability of DNA evidence are resolved. The resolution cites as the main reason for the moratorium widely varying practices among states concerning the admissibility of DNA evidence during trials. The statement also cites the growing number of death penalty cases reversed on appeal due to DNA evidence not available at the original trial. The resolution specifically mentions the current Illinois moratorium on executions. In recent years, 13 Illinois death row inmates were exonerated, some due to DNA evidence. Tuesday morning, the measure will be referred from committee to the full House of Delegates at the AMA's annual meeting. The vote is scheduled for later this week. For NPR News, I'm Jason DeRose in Chicago.
The Justice Department is accusing Visa and MasterCard of violating antitrust laws because of their policy of refusing to allow member banks to issue other credit cards. The government's accusation came at the start of a trial charging the two companies blocked competition to the $1.3 trillion credit card industry. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When Jim Kniffel started writing a column for a Philadelphia weekly in the 80s, he prided himself on his angry and obnoxious tone, which he intended to outrage or at least irritate his readers. And on those terms, he was often successful. Apparently, he had a knack for irritating people in real life, too. What I'm getting to is that you might not expect a writer with his tone to publish two memoirs reflecting on his health problems. His first, Slackjaw, is about a congenital illness that has gradually diminished his eyesight. Now at the age of 35, he's legally blind. Slackjaw was number 3 on Entertainment Weekly's list of the best books of 1999. The citation said, "He's grouchy, he drinks too much, he screws up his relationships, and boy do we love him by the end of this dazzling memoir." His new memoir, Quitting the Nairobi Trio, is about his early suicide attempts and the 6 months he spent in a psychiatric hospital when he was 22. It was a period when he says he was a bit of a thug and a petty thief who never got caught. In his new book, he says he's now too old, too grumpy, too tired, and too curious about the things going on around him to be bothered with trying to take his life anymore. I asked him to tell us more about how he lost interest in suicide, assuming he's still uninterested.
Before I went into the ward, I guess I had a very dark sense of humor, but it usually involved laughing at disasters and the pain inflicted upon other people. But when I got out, something had changed in that I was able to look at my own circumstances, which were pretty bad, and for the first time was really able to laugh at that, and came to realize that if you can't laugh at the awful circumstances that we find ourselves in, then you're pretty much dead already. And so I've just kept laughing at my own pain ever since, and I've been all right.
It's kind of ironic that now that you've lost your vision, you're you're better adjusted than you used to be.
that in itself had a lot to do with it over these past couple of years, because I used to be pretty, well, I was pretty out of control. I was a petty thief and a drunkard and violent, doing all sorts of terrible things, setting fires, what have you. But when I lost my vision, it becomes very, very difficult to do those things. It becomes very difficult to leave, to leave your apartment, and going out and trying to set a fire. Well, that would just be a disaster. it's hard to steal things anymore because you never end up with what you, set out to get in the first place. So it's calmed me down a lot. But I think it's also kept me alive.
Well, let's stop right here for a second.
Yeah.
I'm interested in how you found the tone you wanted for your memoirs, one about your blindness, the other about, your suicide attempts and your stay in a psychiatric hospital. There are so many memoirs now about horrible physical afflictions and
yeah,
so on.
They're all so whiny.
Well, I will say not all of them. But obviously you didn't you wanted a certain kind of tone to fit
yeah.
your more anarchic strange personality. So let's just talk a little bit about the writing of those books before we talk
sure.
about your actual experiences. How what kind of tone you wanted and how you found it?
Well, I had been writing a newspaper column about my own various trials for a good 10 years before someone asked me to write Slackjaw. And so it had developed over the years. I mean, when I started writing, I was a very, very angry young man and was out to burn down the world. And I just wanted to offend people in any possible way, which I found out was a very, very simple thing to do. And so after a few years, it lost its charm. And as other things happened to me, as, as I had to become resigned to things like going blind and what have you, the tone changed. It became, well, still grumpy, certainly, but much less hateful. As I started looking at myself a little more carefully, but still finding the situation, funny, in a demented sort of way. So that's where it came from. And when, I'm not a big fan, strangely enough, of the whole memoir genre, even though I've written two of them, or the what I referred to in the first book as the "Oh my God, I've got a horrible disease" books. I'm just telling my own story the way I wanted to tell it, and without trying to make any kind of point at all.
In your earlier writing, you intentionally yeah. set out to offend people.
Right.
And I think that was probably your style in person often as well. Did that kind of angry, in-your-face mm-hmm. style affect the style of suicide that you chose for yourself when during your suicide attempt period?
I wasn't writing until in any form until long after this had happened. But as far as just my personal style, I don't know that it affected it, because I tried everything under the sun, short of firearms.
What'd you try?
Over the years. Let's see, starting when I was 14, everything from throwing myself downstairs, I drank bleach, I cut my wrists, I walked in front of buses, tried hanging myself, tried Harry Carey. But as it turns out, I wasn't any much better at suicide than I was at anything else I tried to do in this world. Failed at all of them. Granted, most of them were kind of half-assed attempts, but except for this last one, which pretty much did the trick. This time, I ended up much, much closer to the final goal that I thought I had for myself than ever before. And maybe that scared me away from any future attempts, knowing that I really could do it if I set my mind to it.
And that attempt was a combination of over-the-counter sleeping pills and scotch.
Yeah, really, really bad scotch, yeah.
And what were your immediate thoughts when you came to after that? Like, I'm glad I'm still alive, or what?
No, the immediate thought, as I was laying there, when I came to, I was screaming, Nietzsche in German, some of the songs that appear at the beginning of The Gay Science. And
what a literary kind of...
yeah,
the literary way to hallucinate.
Yeah, I don't know where the hell that came from.
I should tell our listeners you were a philosophy major in college and
yeah.
read a lot of philosophy over the years.
Yeah, and read a lot of Nietzsche. But when I came to and I realized that I was strapped down in a bed, strapped down in a hospital bed and was, screaming German in rhyme, I knew that, I had lost my mind finally, that I was now completely insane. And I was tickled pink by that idea, because that meant that I'd be, you know, locked away for the rest of my life, and all I'd have to do to have a roof over my head, to be fed, and have a place to sleep was just to continue saying ridiculous things whenever anybody came around. I'd be free to, you know, read, do whatever I wanted to do. But
was this a big issue that you were really worried about having a roof over your head and having food?
Nah, just that it was the end of all responsibility. It was the end of all personal responsibility. I wouldn't have to worry about, you know, going to work anymore or...
no big decisions to make.
Yeah, I wouldn't have to sweep or wash any dishes. But, of course, being a philosophy major, I immediately realized that being able to think that, you know, being able to take that step outside and look at what I was thinking, you know, namely, I'm insane, meant that I wasn't insane at all. And that really, that put the knife in things. Then I was depressed because, one, I wasn't insane. And two, it also meant that I had failed again.
Well, let's get back to that failure. Why, if you were so determined to kill yourself, why didn't you try something more definitive, like a gun, like jumping off the roof of a tall building, a more definitive kind of overdose?
Well, I guess that's always the question, isn't it? You know, people ask me why I didn't get a gun. Sometimes I ask myself why I didn't go out and get a gun. I think at the heart of all of it has always been a sort of cowardice. I mean, I'll admit to that freely. I also didn't know where to get a gun because I couldn't get one legally because I'd been in institutions before after, year earlier after cutting my wrists, and I didn't know where in Minneapolis, which is, you know, a very safe town, you know, where I could go and buy one on a, you know, street corner. But I think in the end it was cowardice. I mean, I thought at the time, and I thought for months in advance, that I wanted to kill myself. But I think when you really got right down to it, maybe I didn't.
My guest is Jim Kniffel. He's a columnist for the New York Press and the author of two memoirs. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jim Kniffel. He's the author of the new memoir, Quitting the Nairobi Trio, about his suicide attempts and his six-month stay at a psychiatric hospital when he was 22. You know, there's a feeling I think it's fair to say a lot of people have had this. You're driving along the road and you're thinking, just for that split second, I could drive off the road. You know, I could drive off the bridge. I could jump off the bridge. But you don't. You know, you just kind of flirt with that idea for like a split second, and of course you don't do it. It's just this kind of like odd thing to wonder about. What would it be like if? But you've actually kind of gone there. You know, you've slit your wrist. You're throwing yourself down a flight of stairs and drunk bleach.
Yeah.
So
tried to jump off a bridge once too, but it was pulled back.
Right.
Anyway.
Uh-huh. but here's what I'm wondering: like when you pick up that razor and you say, "Okay, I'm gonna slice my wrist," and then you actually slice them.
Right.
What went through your mind during that moment when the razor actually hit the wrist and you actually, you went there, you know, you crossed over that border from maybe I'll do this too, I did this.
Right. That's actually, I can't say what it's like for other people, but from my own experience, that was always very interesting. Having tried so many times, the process was always the same. I would think about it for months. I would create a plan and obsess on that plan, you know, was all I thought about for months and months and months until finally I reached the point where I did do something like that. I did open up the package of razors And what happened with me in all of these cases is that when I actually did these things, when I actually took that final step, it was always very cathartic. You know, when I actually did something, it was a definitive action that I had taken because, you know, you haven't yet asked why I was doing this, you know, what was wrong with me. And the answer, I don't know if it's an accurate answer, but it was the answer I've been telling myself for, you know, 20 years now, is that I spent so much time trying to kill myself because I was bored. Just the repetition of everyday life was just became almost tangibly painful to me, taking a bus every day and taking it home and tying my shoes. It just got too much to bear. And by putting, say, a blade to my wrist and drawing blood, that was a step outside. Violent and self-destructive as it was, it still released something in my head, and I wouldn't do anything for another, you know, 18 months. I, you know, felt cleaned out after doing something like that, which I guess saying it now sounds kind of sick, but it worked for me.
Well, if it was, you know, the boredom with the routine of daily life, the tying of your shoes, the taking the bus, there's other options like moving or...
Well, I did move around an awful lot.
Right.
Yeah.
I guess you still have to tie your shoes.
Yeah,
I mean, that is
you know... I still don't know how.
It is a kind of extreme response.
Yeah.
I mean, there had to be something else going on. I mean, as tedious as tying one's shoes might be, that it's usually not... a compelling reason for killing yourself.
Well, it was enough for me.
I mean, you obviously had a whopping case of depression.
Yeah, that went on for some time. And I can't put my finger on, you know, why. I mean, I've talked to various shrinks over the years. I mean, I came from a wonderful family with, you know, loving and caring parents and, you know, in Green Bay, Wisconsin, you know, solidly middle class. And, you know, things from the outside were okay. It's just that something was very, very wrong inside my head.
There's so many more pharmaceutical options than there were when you were first depressed.
Yeah.
Have any of those helped you?
Nah. I mean, I tried a bunch. I've had doctors throw them at me, and I try them for a while, and they may work for a little while, but then they stop working, and whatever was wrong is still there. You know, the best, having seen a few of these people over the years, the best one I ever saw was I was living in Madison, and it was after I did the wrists. I saw him for maybe 6 months, and he sat me down at the end. We decided this was the last session, and he said, "Now, Jim, you are not a horrible person, but the world is a horrible, horrible place. So you've got to take all of that rage and all of that anger that's inside of you. Stop trying to kill yourself with it. Turn it around. Go out there and try and destroy the world instead." And that worked wonders for a good long time, at least for me, because I did go out and try and destroy the world for a while, got into loads of trouble, but had loads of fun trying.
That doesn't necessarily sound like the good advice for the rest of society. Like if that advice resulted in you stealing. You know, shoplifting and setting fires and things like that. There are victims on the other end.
Yeah, well, at the time, I guess I wasn't much concerned about that. That was my sociopathic period.
You sure the doctor didn't mean try to destroy what's evil in the world as opposed to just try to destroy the world?
Maybe that was the part of the sentence I didn't catch.
Yeah, maybe you got the wrong message. If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Jim Kniffel, and he has two memoirs. His memoir, Slackjaw, which is in part about losing his eyesight, just came out in paperback, and his new memoir, Quitting the Nairobi Trio, is about his suicide attempts and his 6-month stay in a psychiatric hospital. Boy, it sounds like you got a lot of problems when I say that, doesn't it?
I have not begun to, you know, list them.
You say that when you're on the verge of suicide, the last thing you can think about is the people you love or the people who love you, because
right,
if you go there, you won't be able to go through with it.
Right.
But when you come to and people you love, like your parents, are actually there.
Right.
What do you feel about how they feel about what you've done? I mean, they're obviously going to be really upset.
Yeah, that's actually how I opened the book is you know, when I came to, and you know, there's my mom sitting there. You know, that doesn't feel so good, because you know, you've let them down again, because they'd, you know, been through this before with me, and I felt pretty rotten about that, and was actually a little hesitant to send copies of the books to them, you know, because I didn't want to bring all this back, but it worked out, you know. We got through it.
Jim Kniffel is the author of the new memoir, Quitting the Nairobi Trio. His earlier memoir, Slackjaw, is out in paperback. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House Inc.'s Bantam Books Division, publisher of After the Ecstasy, The Laundry, How the Heart Grows Wise on the Spiritual Path by Jack Kornfield. From eTapestry.com. Creator of web-based fundraising software for managing the donor information of large, medium, and small nonprofits, eTapestry.com. And from Random House, Inc., Crown Division, publishers of The Forest, the novel by Edward Rutherford, author of London and Sarum. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, Jim Kniffel talks about how losing his eyesight has changed his life and his disposition. And Ken Tucker reviews the second volume of Woody Guthrie lyrics set to music by Billy Bragg and Wilco. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jim Kniffel. He's a columnist for the New York Press and has written two memoirs. His new one is about his angry young man period, when he attempted suicide several times and spent 6 months in a psychiatric hospital. His first memoir is about slowly losing his eyesight as a result of a congenital illness. He's now 35 and legally blind. Your first book is dedicated to your parents, about who you
right.
say they have never once given up hope, even after I have, time and time again. I love them with all I have. When you were going through your extreme angry young man period, and you were intentionally offending everyone around you, did you intentionally offend your parents a lot and do things designed to hurt them?
Never anything designed to hurt them. I'll tell you. During the whole angry young man business, I was living in Madison, Minneapolis, Philadelphia, New York, and I never sent them the stories I was writing, and I didn't tell them anything that I was doing. We kept in contact, but you know, I just didn't tell them, and so when I sent them the galleys of Slackjaw, I wrote a long letter and sent along with it saying, look, you might not know about some of these things, and some of these things may be painful to you, but just know, you know, I'm okay, I'm still alive, and I still love you. And it was funny, because after they read the book, they called me, and they said, you know, We sort of had an idea that something like that was going on, which I think just goes to show that parents are never really quite as stupid as you think they are. They had a very good idea what I was up to, but just never bugged me about it.
Mm-hmm.
Everything worked out again.
Do you think you still are prone to depressions?
Oh, hell yeah.
Uh-huh.
Nothing quite as... I guess I'm more grumpy than depressed these days. Kind of slow moving. But nothing compared to just the long stretches of impenetrable darkness that I used to live in. You know.
Of course, now you live in a more literal darkness because you've lost your eyesight.
Right.
But is there a difference between literal darkness and metaphorical darkness?
Yeah, literal darkness is more physically painful when I keep kicking things.
Oh, walking into things.
The walking into things and what have you. But I'm more comfortable here. I'm more comfortable without eyesight than I think I was with it.
What? Why is that?
Lord knows. Maybe because when I had my eyesight, I could see how ugly things really were. And now I just have memories of sight, and most of those were okay. You know, because I remember the things I like, but that's just a guess.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jim Kniffel, and he has two memoirs. His new book, Quitting the Nairobi Trio, is about a period of his life when he had several suicide attempts and spent 6 months in a psychiatric hospital. And his first book, which has recently come out in paperback, which is called Slackjaw, is about another big problem that he's faced, which is a disease which has caused him to lose his eyesight almost totally, but not completely totally.
Yeah.
What is the condition that you have?
It's called retinitis pigmentosa. Essentially, it means that beginning at birth, the rods and cones in my retinas, which are the cells which capture light and send them on to the optic nerve, just started dissolving from the outside in. That is to say, I lost my peripheral vision first, my night vision, and... the central vision held for a while, but that's pretty much shot these days. I can still maneuver in the streets if the sun is out, if a bit awkwardly. I can still work on a computer if I, say, blow up the fonts of the text large enough. So I can still see a little bit, although it's extremely limited.
What kind of aids do you use when you're walking on the street? Do you have a cane, a dog?
I use the cane. I don't use it nearly as often as I should, which is a sort of a twisted pride issue, I suppose, because I don't want to make a big deal out of the blindness. I just want to, deal with it in my own way. The cane is necessary when after the sun goes down, because then I'm just then I can't see a damn thing.
What about a dog? Some of those seeing eye dogs, they seem like such magnificent animals.
Oh yeah, I got nothing against the dogs, but I have two cats at home, and they would kill it. And I live in a small apartment in Brooklyn. Not yet.
Right. There's in your memoir Slackjaw, you write a little bit about this technique you were taught when you were given your cane, about how to pull your arm away from people who want to help you when you don't want to be helped.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, something that my various instructors warned me about, and which I found to be absolutely true, is that if you're walking down a street and you're using the cane, there are people out there, people who wake up in the morning and somehow, for some reason, they get the idea in their heads that they are going to help you, whether you want it or not. And I've had more than my share of situations where I have been walking down the street and just had people swoop upon me and grab one of my arms and just start dragging me along in some direction that, I can't see where the hell they're taking me. Because normally the way things work with the blind is you're supposed to let us... Oh, I say us. I shouldn't say that. You're supposed to let, the blind person take your arm and not take theirs. It just makes things easier and gives them a little sense of control. So I was instructed in a little two-move gesture, if someone does that, that involves like shooting the arm straight up in the air and then pulling the fingers away, unclawing them. Though I've never used that. I'm still prone to just hitting people with the cane.
Have you really done that?
Which seems to work much, much better. So...
What about if the person is genuinely well-intentioned and you start banging them with the cane?
Oh, I don't care. No, I mean, I tell them first, I warn them.
Oh, first you say it nicely.
Of course.
Right.
I'm a sweetie pie, please let the hell, let my arm alone or I'm going to hit you with this cane. But, I've had people drag me through puddles. Most people... I found, and this was very, very surprising, living in New York as I do, that most people are real cool, and there are people out there who are genuinely helpful, and I appreciate that, who will, give me some verbal clues, mm-hmm. a little to your right, are you going to run into this, or traffic's coming or not coming, or the light's about to change, and that's wonderful. And that's very, very helpful. It's the do-gooders that that bother me.
My guest is Jim Kniffel. He's a columnist for the New York Press and the author of two memoirs. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Jim Kniffel. He has two memoirs. His first, Slackjaw, just came out in paperback, and his new book is called Quitting the Nairobi Trio. You majored in philosophy in college, and even before that were reading philosophy books. You obviously had some, you know, some real genuine interest in that. Has all the books that you've read helped you make sense of things that have been out of your control that have happened in your life, like the depressions, like the loss of sight?
Not in the least.
well, that's reassuring, isn't it?
Yeah, to be perfectly blunt, I studied philosophy for many, many, many years, and it didn't take me that long after I stopped to get over it. I do, however, hang on to things I've read by Beckett, by Mr. Pynchon, by Henry Miller. You know, the novels I've read have helped me out much more than any of the philosophy.
How has losing your sight affected your subjects as a writer? I mean, obviously you have a memoir about losing your sight, but like when you're functioning as a reporter or a columnist, do you feel like your subject matter has been closed down or opened up in any way?
Well, it's been closed down a little, and it's an interesting thing that I was actually just thinking about a couple of weeks ago. Is so you read the first in the first two books, you'll see that most of the details are visual. There are a lot of things about color, placement of objects, and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
In the more recent things that I've been doing, most of the details are oral, because I can't, you know, I can't see the details too well. And so it's just, it's based on what I overhear on sound rather than sight.
What about your dreams? Do you have sight in your dreams?
Yeah. Actually, I was asked this once by a woman who specializes in dreams. But it is interesting that in my dreams I have sight, but I can't see much better. I mean, it's still extremely limited because that's all I've ever known. You know, I have very little peripheral vision in my dreams, so there's a lot of scanning involved, swinging back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Earlier when we were talking, you were talking about, I think it was when we were talking about learning to use a cane, and you said something about us referring to blind people, and then you kind of verbally crossed out the us and made it clear you didn't want to. What's wrong with using the word us in context of being one of a larger group of people?
Yeah, I've never been much of a joiner to any sort of organization. This is an extremely un-PC way of looking at things, I suppose, but I think it's a very human way of looking at things, is that there's no way to avoid in one way or another sort of being uncomfortable when you're confronted with the other, as some philosophers may call it. And I'm that way, too. I still get uncomfortable around, say, the blind or the crippled, even though I'm one of them. But I'm just not interested in, you know, group activities at all.
So some people find solace in a sense of connection with other people who kind of face the same problems that they face.
Yeah, and that's fine for them.
You don't get that.
I don't know. I never, I've never joined a political party. I've never enjoyed regular parties. I don't work well with, I don't play well with others, I guess you could say.
The subtitle of your memoir, Slackjaw, is, let me get it so I can read it exactly. You better start learning Braille now.
Yeah, actually, that's not really a subtitle so much as just a funny little thing they decided to put on the cover.
Oh.
But it does come from a good story. When I was 14, Sometimes I forget, but my grandmother had died. And I went to the funeral, which is in northern Wisconsin. And while I was sitting there, I was approached by my Uncle Tom, who, as it turns out, though I didn't know it then, and nobody knew it then except him, had the same condition that I had. And he was much older. He was in his 30s, who came over to me, didn't say hello, didn't greet me in any way, just said, "Well, you better start learning Braille now." And then he didn't say anything else, and I vowed to avoid him for the rest of the afternoon. But he was dead on. You know, no doctor was able to diagnose this until I was 23, 24. But he knew way back then, and nobody listened to him.
Have you learned to read Braille?
No. You know, they don't teach it anymore. There's one little mail order school out in, I believe it's Indiana, that still teaches it. But your basic blind man organizations don't. They think it's a waste of time, and they think it's too expensive, and I think it takes too long, which is true. It's very, very difficult. And the fact of the matter is, living in this modern age as we do, most everything talks. So Braille is fading anyway. You know, you have books on tape, you have, you know, talking cabs and subways and what have you. And it's funny that you still run across public Braille, but it's always in the most ridiculous places. On touchscreen ATMs.
Right, yes, that's right, I've noticed
yeah,
that.
What the hell's the point of that? Essentially, I mean, I still think, you know, it's, if I could read that, it'd say something like, what are you thinking? You know, you're out of luck here, Buster. And you find it in museums. I know I used to work at the Guggenheim, and we had plates up there, and they have them down in the subways. Plates identifying the station, but it's inevitably put on a post just 4 inches from the edge of the platform in the darkest, narrowest corner down in the subway. It's somebody with a very, very sick sense of humor who's putting up these Braille plates around New York, and I want that job.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's a sense of humor like yours. You could do good at that.
Yeah.
Well, Jim, it's been great to talk with you. I want to thank you very much.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure, Ms. Gross. Thank you so much for having me on.
Jim Kniffel's new memoir is called Quitting the Nairobi Trio. His first memoir, Slackjaw, is out in paperback. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews Billy Bragg and Wilco's second volume of Woody Guthrie songs. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. 2 years ago, the English folk singer Billy Bragg collaborated with the American rock band Wilco to record a set of Woody Guthrie lyrics that hadn't previously been set to music. The CD was called Mermaid Avenue. Rock critic Ken Tucker placed it on his list of the best releases of that year. Now Bragg and Wilco are back with a sequel, Mermaid Avenue Volume 2, and Ken is pleasantly surprised.
Do you still sing of the mountain bed we made of limbs and leaves? Do you still sigh there near the sky where the holly berry bleeds? You laughed as I covered you over with leaves, fists, breasts, hips, and thighs. You smiled and I said the leaves were just the color of your eyes.
The odds against a satisfying sequel to a first-rate piece of popular art are steep indeed. What is there? The Godfather Part II? Certainly. Philip Roth's Zuckerman Unbound or John Updike's Rabbit is Rich? Anyway, Mermaid Avenue Volume 2 is a pleasant shock. You'd have thought that Billy Bragg, wearing his archivist's hard hat, would have mined the motherlode of unrecorded Woody Guthrie lyrics the first time around. But listen to this torrid piece of rockabilly that Bragg and Wilco have made out of this fine political screed called All You Fascists.
I'm going to tell all you fascists, you may be surprised. People all over this world are getting organized to bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. Race hatred cannot stop us, this one.
On the other hand, there are also more of the gorgeously simple romantic songs that made the first Mermaid Avenue a revelation to those of us who thought of Guthrie primarily as the forceful patriot of This Land Is Your Land. Turns out he was also a lyrical romanticist as well.
Who can guess the secret of the sea? Who can guess the secret of the sea?
Once again, the collaborators mesh styles with just the right proportion of rough edges and a common belief that Guthrie's verbal rhythms can hold up to all sorts of arrangements, instrumental accompaniment, and emotional tone. And then there are times when Wilco lead vocalist Jeff Tweedy seems to be channeling Guthrie straight through his soul, as when he delivers this stern reminder of Christ's precepts called Blood of the Lamb.
Are you coming out spotless? Are they white as the snow? Are you washed in the blood of the Lamb? Is your soul out spotless? Is it clean as the snow? Are you washed in the blood of the Lamb?
If anything, I think I almost prefer this Mermaid Avenue to its predecessor. It's more extreme, veering wildly from a thunderous Jeremiad called Feed of Man that reminds you how Bob Dylan used Guthrie's work as inspiration, to lighter, dreamier songs like Secret of the Sea and My Flying Saucer. Maybe Billy Bragg has unearthed even more of this stuff while investigating Guthrie's archives with Woody's daughter, Nora. If so, by all means, let's visit Mermaid Avenue a third time as soon as possible.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Mermaid Avenue Volume 2 by Billy Bragg and Wilco. Fresh Air's senior producer today was Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, and Megan Howell. Research assistance from Helen Wong. I'm Terry Gross.
It's against the law to walk, against the law to talk, against the law to love, against the law to work, against the law to read, against the law to write, against the law to be, black or brown or white. Everything against the law. I'm a low big daddy singing a high price blue.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Alcatel, providing integrated voice and data networks for the internet, enterprises, and carriers worldwide. At www.alcatel.com. From lawyers.com, an online legal resource for identifying and hiring a lawyer. AOL keyword, lawyers.com. And from Random House Inc.'s Bantam Books Division. Publisher of Off the Mangrove Coast by Louis L'Amour, a new collection of adventure tales. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, singer and songwriter Amy Mann. She was nominated for an Academy Award for her song Save Me from the film Magnolia. She has a new CD. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
I can't do it. I can't conceive. Everything you're trying to make.